Details of what we can expect in the July jobs stimulus plan are carried in this morning's Irish Times. Jennifer Bray and Jack Horgan-Jones report that youth unemployment has been highlighted as a key focus. Measures under consideration include a significant investment in apprenticeships, as well as back to education allowances for those on the pandemic unemployment payment to enable them learn new skills and transition off social welfare. Special consideration will be given to supporting the arts, but some government sources expressed scepticism about the possibility of a reduction in VAT for the hospitality sector. The Irish Daily Mail gives front page coverage to comments from the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar that working from home will become the new normal. COVID-19 threw many of us into working remotely for the first time, he said, describing it as an accelerator of change that was coming. Mr. Varadkar believes the benefits will be huge, pointing to reduced business costs, better work-life balance, less traffic, fewer greenhouse gas emissions and time saved on the commute. Draft documents from the Department of Agriculture seen by the Irish Farmers Journal reveal that the government's priorities for Irish agriculture under the next Common Agricultural Policy. Priority one on the department's list is to support a viable farm income and close the gap between agriculture and other sectors of the economy. The document also sets out the need to attract more young farmers by offering income supports and increasing land transfers through succession planning. The Irish Independent reports that the Green Party has backtracked on its demand that Under Fire Agriculture Minister Barry Cowan explain why he was on a provisional driver's licence when he was stopped for drink driving. Party leader Eamon Ryan and his deputy Catherine Martin both publicly insisted that Mr Cowan should address the issues involved, but have now rowed back on those demands and accepted Minister Cowan's statement. Also in The Independent, a report from Catherine Donnelly that points to study medicine are expected to rise. It's thought the high-profile work of doctors and other medical staff on the front line fighting the pandemic may have fueled the popularity of the health sciences. The headline on the front of the Irish Examiner is Massive Bill for ESB over Flood Ruling. The paper tells us that the ESB is facing a compensation bill that could run into tens of millions of euro after the Supreme Court ruled it was negligent when floods deluged Cork City in 2009. In the Irish Daily Star, Chief Reporter Paul Healy details how Gardaí and the Army raided a compound in County Meath where it's believed that a couple were last seen alive. Four people have been arrested as part of the investigation into the killing and disappearance of a Dublin-based couple in 2015. The Irish Daily Mirror covers a commitment from the Taoiseach to tackle banks which charge customers interest during emergency mortgage breaks, while the Irish Sun reports that the Spanish government is attempting to use our low corporate tax rates to shoot down Pascal Donoghue's hopes of becoming president of the Eurogroup finance ministers. The Herald reports that a company controlled by developer Johnny Ronan has launched a legal action against Bewley's Cafe on Grafton Street. The company is seeking rental arrears and possession of the property. The Irish News highlights a warning from Northern Ireland's chief medical officer that travellers from Britain present the greatest risk of bringing coronavirus into the north, while the Belfast Telegraph informs us that plastic accounts for almost 80% of litter on the north's beaches, made up mainly of single-use items such as drink bottles and food wrappers.
Eurozone finance ministers will pick a new president of the Eurogroup later today. Ireland's Minister Pascal Donoghue is one of three candidates nominated for the position. Our Europe editor Tony Connolly is with us. Morning, Tony. What does president of the Eurogroup do?
The president has to chair Eurogroup meetings a couple of times a month, every month. He or she has to coordinate policy, try and build consensus among the 19 finance ministers, and to steer all of the big key issues that the Eurogroup and the Eurozone face over time. Now, we can recall that during the Eurozone debt crisis, the Eurogroup was meeting all the time in a period of really frenzied crisis over the Greek debt situation, the Greek bailout, then the Portuguese and the Irish bailouts, and the whole threat to the euro currency itself. It had a very high profile role at that point. Jeroen Dijsselbloem was the president back then, and he was almost a household name at that point. These days, the Eurogroup doesn't quite have that profile. With the pandemic, all of the activity has been the EU as a whole. The recovery plan is an EU-wide plan. It's not restricted to the Eurozone. But the Eurogroup did pull together and agree a €540 billion immediate plan some weeks after the pandemic struck. But the Eurogroup has been really damaged by divisions between North and South over the debtor countries and creditor countries. And that has tarnished its image somewhat. And that's really the backdrop to this contest today.
Now, three candidates for this contest. How will the winner be picked?
It'll be a fairly straightforward contest. So there are 19 finance ministers, each has a vote. And so whoever gets to 10 votes will become the next president of the Eurogroup. We have three candidates. Pierre Gramegna is the Luxembourg finance minister. Nadia Calviño is the Spanish finance minister. She's probably seen as the front runner because she has the support of all the bigger Eurozone members. But of course, it is only one country, one vote. And then you have Pascal Donoghue. Now, he has presented himself as a bridge builder. Ireland has, since Brexit, aligned itself to the northern countries, to the more fiscally prudent member states like the Netherlands, the Baltic countries, Denmark, and so on. Yet, when the pandemic struck, Ireland threw its weight in with the southern countries for a much bigger response, a bigger debt response from the southern countries. So Pascal Donoghue has been presenting himself as a bridge builder, and also the whole narrative of a country like Ireland, which underwent a bailout, but then became recovered from the bailout and is now a net contributor to the EU. So that's part of the narrative that I suppose he's been selling in the contest.
Will he win?
Well, this is the big question. As I mentioned, Nadia Calviño probably is the front runner.
Yes.
We would suggest that in the first round, Pierre Gramegna, the Luxembourg candidate, will probably have to bow out because he only has the support, it looks like, at least, of the Benelux countries. So then it would be a straight runoff between Pascal Donoghue and Nadia Calviño, the Spanish finance minister. And that's where he may be in an advantageous position, because even though she's supported by the bigger member states, the countries who supported the Luxembourg candidate may throw their weight behind Ireland. That's a more likely fit, if you like, and that could start to bring the numbers up for Pascal Donoghue. But we'll see at around 5 o'clock Irish time this afternoon.
What happens if he wins? What difference will it make to Ireland?
Well, I suppose what happens when he wins is he will then have to double his role as Ireland's finance minister and the president of the Eurogroup. He will have to be in Brussels a couple of times a month. He will have to oversee the various bodies that feed into the work of the Eurogroup. There's a thing called the Eurogroup Working Group. There are various other secretarial elements to this as well within the various institutions. But he's going to have to steer all of the big issues over time. And one tricky issue, I think, for Ireland will be the digital tax. This is an idea that Ireland has opposed for many years, that you have a special tax for big digital multinational companies. And that idea has come back into vogue because the EU is going to launch a huge recovery fund with the European Commission borrowing on the international markets up to €750 billion. That money will have to be paid back over time. And one of the ideas that's being kicked around is that you tax big multinational companies a bit more than they are at the moment. Ireland has been opposed to that. So Pascal Donoghue, if he is elected, would have to be an honest broker on that issue as it's being steered through. But apart from that, this doesn't accrue any extra or additional benefits to Ireland, apart from the prestige of having a large EU institutional position.
Tony, thank you. That's our Europe editor, Tony Connolly. As he said, we should know the results by about 5 o'clock today, 18 minutes past 7.
The Taoiseach told last night's meeting of the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party that he intends to rejuvenate the party during its time in government. Micheál Martin was speaking as questions continued about Barry Cowan's driving record, but there was apparently no mention of the Agriculture Minister's drink driving offence last night. For more, let's talk to the Ireland editor of the Irish Independent, Fiona Sheehan. Fionnán, no mention of Barry Cowan last night. What did the TDs and senators discuss?
Well, Micheál Martin managed to get through a lengthy meeting without snubbing, upsetting any of his TDs or disrespecting any of their communities. So that's a success on his part. Largely speaking, Micheál Martin outlined his plans for wide-scale consultation within the party while they're in government. So there's going to be all sorts of groups set up for TDs and senators to talk to ministers, downwards towards the councillors and national executive. And there'll be lots of work for idle hands and people who have been complaining that they've been left out of the process as a result of not being picked as ministers. Micheál Martin seemed to be very much at ease last night at the meeting. People said it was a good performance on his part. He acknowledged that some people were upset by events of last week, but determined that it was time to move on. It was kind of back to normal. The big topic of the night was the issue of forestry. So people will be familiar with that landslide in Drumcairn in North Leitrim last week. And that has again raised this issue about licensing and planning for forestry developments. A big issue down your own country in Clare as well, Rachel. And Barry Cowan, the Minister for Agriculture, addressed the meeting. The people said it was notable that He marched up to the podium at the top of the room in order to address the crowd in something of a show of confidence. And he said he was going to implement an independent review into that matter in Drumcairn, and also would advance some changes to planning laws whereby the licensing for forestry, the application and appeals mm-hmm. process would be more like a planning application. That's in the programme for government, so he's going to move fast on that. There was a bit of gentle ribbing there from Mark McSharry that he only had his feet in under the table and he was already announcing independent reviews, but there was nothing terribly serious. The only dissent in the ranks last night seemed to be from John McGuinness, the usual suspect, who was complaining that they were sounding a bit Fine Gaelish inside in the Dáil. He seemed to also be have an issue with the July stimulus package that sounded a bit Fine Gaely. And Robert Troy, the junior minister for trade, and it would appear for also Mark and John McGuinness, responded saying that the policy hadn't even been published yet, so it was difficult to say that. And he also went into how there had been a lot of consultation with business groups on that matter. So, you know, he was batting for his party leader too.
I love the idea of having a junior minister for marking John McGuinness. Are there still questions about Barry Cowan's statement, though?
Well, the Green Party seemed to be happy with saying 2 days ago to your colleague Sarah McInerney that there were questions to answer around his provisional licence, and that was Eamon Ryan. And then yesterday, Catherine Martin, the deputy leader, said that he hadn't answered those questions, but they seem to have let them slide. So the general view within Fianna Fáil is that he's a bit wounded by it all. Proceeding from here, he wouldn't want to be attracting much more controversy over the coming months. I think that issue of the provisional licence, he didn't exactly avail of the opportunity in the Dáil the other night to put every bit of information out there that he mm-hmm. possibly could, which was rather a curious strategy. You go back to there was a good Bertie Ahern tactic when he used to be up to his trouble. He used to drown people in information and data, and that would distract people, and he could then say, well, look, I've put everything out there. Barry Cowan chose not to do that. No doubt now today there'll be focus on Sinn Féin. Their party TD, Pat Buckley, admitting that he was driving on a learner's licence when he was caught drink driving, and he was put off the road for 3 years, not 3 months.
He wasn't a TD at the time, though. Sure, he wasn't.
You're going back to 2013. I think not in his case. He took over that seat in 2016, but he was very much a prominent Sinn Féin activist at that particular time.
Fionnán, thank you for joining us this morning. That was the Ireland editor of the Irish Independent, Fionnán Sheehan.
There's been a big rise in the number of cases of people looking for help because of their use of illegal drugs. There were over 10,000 cases last year, some of people looking for help more than once. Opioids, including heroin, were the most common reason, but cocaine was the second most common, overtaking cannabis. The average age of people looking for help was 30, and the vast majority were men. The study of people treated for drug use in 2019 was carried out by the Health Research Board. Dr. Anne-Marie Carew is a research officer with the board. Anne-Marie, good morning. Thanks for taking our call today.
Good morning.
Tell me about what this study tells us about the use of cocaine here and the number of people seeking treatment.
This report from the Health Research Board today looks at problem drug use in Ireland over the 7 year period between 2013 and 2019. And it shows that almost 68,000 cases were treated for problem drug use during this time. And last year alone, nearly 11,000 cases were treated, which is a small increase compared to the previous year. Now, our key finding is that the number of cocaine cases continues to increase. Cocaine was the primary issue for one in four people treated in 2019, and we saw a threefold increase in cocaine figures. It accounted for approximately one in 10 back in 2013, and this has risen to one in four cases last year. We have also seen that cocaine has now overtaken cannabis as the second most common drug that people receive treatment for.
What about crack cocaine?
In general, those who are seeking treatment for cocaine tend to seek treatment for powder cocaine. However, we are seeing a rise in reporting for crack cocaine. It rose from 11% in 2018 to 14% last year. Now, this is a concern because it indicates a level of chronic problem drug use. These cases are more likely to be unemployed or to be homeless. And it's an important distinction between those who are more socially integrated cocaine users and also those who are more marginalised, because the types of supports that a person may need may in fact be different.
And are you seeing a difference in the profile of people who are seeking treatment for cocaine as against crack cocaine, and why?
Well, the profile of somebody seeking treatment for cocaine tends to be young males who are working. We found in our report today from the Health Research Board that 8 in 10 were male, half were young, they were aged 30 years or younger, and a very small proportion were under the age of 18. Now, compared to other groups in treatment, we found there were comparatively higher levels of employment. And in fact, we found that the proportion of cases in paid employment had jumped. It's doubled between 2013 and 2018. The profile of those, however, seeking treatment for crack cocaine is different. They tend to be more likely to be unemployed or to be homeless.
Why didn't this study look at alcohol?
So our report today looks at figures treated for problem drug use over the last 7 years. We have another report coming out shortly which looks at alcohol.
Why the distinction?
We make the distinction between drug cases and alcohol cases because they tend to be different profiles and require different types of treatment.
What about other drugs, for example, nitrous oxide or Lyrica?
So in our report, we found that opioids, mainly made up of heroin, continue to be the main problem drug. However, we did see a rise in figures for benzodiazepines, which are by and far the fourth most common drug reported, accounting for approximately one in 10 cases. You mentioned Lyrica there. Lyrica or pregabalin, it's a prescribable drug. When it's used under medical supervision, it is effective for conditions such as epilepsy, neuropathic pain, and chronic anxiety disorders. However, there is a risk of misuse. And it is clear from our data that people have started to misuse this drug over the last couple of years. And we're starting now to see people in treatment for problematic use. So when this drug is combined then with other substances, for example, like alcohol or benzodiazepines or other opioids, it does increase the risk of overdose or fatal overdose.
Anne-Marie Carew, Dr. Anne-Marie Carew from the Health Research Board, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning. 28 minutes past seven. Brian Finn has the business news.
Thanks, Gavin. Good morning. The group behind DIY brands Chadwicks and Buddy's has reported a drop of almost a fifth in group revenue for the first 6 months to just over £1 billion. Grafton said trading in June was more resilient than expected. Strong demand in Ireland and the Netherlands was partly offset by a slower pace of recovery in the traditional distribution and manufacturing businesses in the UK. Dublin-listed property group Hibernia REIT said over 95% of rent due from its tenants for the second quarter of the year had been collected by July 8th. In an interim statement, the group, which mainly operates in the Dublin office market, said 3.5% of rent due was deferred and was expected to be paid this month. 1% remains unpaid. Groups representing the restaurant and pub sectors have called on the government to match the VAT rate cut announced by the UK government. VAT on hospitality services in the UK is set to be cut from 20 to 5% for a period of 6 months from next week. IBEX Danny McCoy said the Irish economy could afford to match that rate for the tourism and hospitality sector here. Currencies, the euro is trading at $1.13.5 and 89.9 pence sterling.
And here with the sport is Darren Frahill. Morning to you, Darren.
And a very good morning to you as well, Rachel. I guess none of us were really surprised yesterday when the 2020 Ryder Cup was postponed because of the COVID-19 pandemic. A little bit disappointed, but you just can't see something like this going ahead without fans, can you? The European Ryder Cup captain, Padraig Harrington, has welcomed the decision, and he's also confirmed a change in qualifying for Team Europe. So the current point system will be frozen until the new year.
I'd say up to 6 weeks ago, we were full steam ahead trying to get organised for, you know, what the team is going to look like in 2020. I think over the last number of weeks, you know, we're starting to come more to conclusion that this thing is going to be difficult to go ahead. So we have been looking into what would look like if we moved to 2021. And I think it's very reasonable. In Europe, we've suspended the point system. We don't want to force any player to have to come out and try and compete at this moment. If he doesn't feel safe or comfortable travelling, he can stay at home and will not lose out in terms of the Ryder Cup qualification. It's going to all start again in January 1st. Things will certainly be clearer at that stage, so players can make their own decisions on what they want to do, and the points will start up, and we'll have a team come 2021 that will have a mixture of experience and current form. And I think it was going to be difficult to have that current form coming into this Ryder Cup if it went ahead. Some players mightn't have played, some players might have only played a couple of events in Europe. So the one thing with the European team we've done over the years is we've had great rookies. You know, the rookies who come in current form, they play their way into the team, they bring such a spirit to the team, and that possibly was going to be missing this time round. You know, if you didn't have current form, what were you going to do? And some players just are not getting a fair crack at a whip if it was in 2020. But everybody's going to have a good chance. And also, anybody who's earned points up to now, they're not going to lose out. Those points are going to continue on and be kept.
And another big positive from that is it's going to be a brilliant September 2021 for golf, because we have the Solheim Cup as well. So we'll have the women's and the men's team golf team events in the same month, within a couple of weeks of each other. So that is quite exciting, and I'm sure there'll be lots of hype about it as well. Mo Salah scored twice as champions Liverpool beat Brighton 3-1. Now, if I'm being completely honest with you, he probably should have got a couple of more as well. Missed some great chances, maybe a bit selfish at times. The bad news for Liverpool, though, is Jordan Henderson went off injured in that game. It looked pretty serious. I know very early days yet, but didn't look comfortable at all. Manchester City beat Newcastle 5-0. Burnley had a 1-0 win at West Ham. And Sheffield United, 1-0 winners against Wolves. Irish defender John Egan on the mark again with the only goal of the game. It came in the 93rd minute, his second goal in as many games. And that win sees his team go seventh. They're a point behind Wolves, and they're in pole position for a place in Europe next season. Sheffield United, just a couple of seasons ago, were in League One, remember, have never qualified for a major European tournament before. And remarkable, they were also one of the favourites to be relegated at the start of the campaign. Their manager is Chris Wilder.
A huge performance. I would go to say one of the biggest since I've been here. Team stretched, playing a top quality, top class team, manager, players. I love watching my team.
West Brom, topped the championship after a 2-0 win against Derby. Leeds in action tonight. Former Irish international John Sheridan has been confirmed as the new manager of Waterford. And finally, there's racing this afternoon at Navan. And the action there gets underway at 5 minutes past one.
Now, the task force set up by the government to help tourism recover from the impact of COVID-19 has said this country should follow the UK's lead and cut VAT for hotels and restaurants. Yesterday, Britain's Chancellor Rishi Sunak announced that VAT was to be cut to just 5% for the hospitality and tourism sector. The new rate will last for 6 months. It's a move that's been welcomed in the north. Joining us are Ruth Andrews, who's the chair of the Tourism Recovery Task Force, and John McGrillan, who's Chief Executive of Tourism Northern Ireland. You're both very welcome to the programme. Can I start with you, Ruth Andrews? I know the Minister for Enterprise, Leo Varadkar, has said the government's considering a VAT cut. However, this morning's Irish Times says that there's scepticism about the effectiveness of this. Does that statement concern you?
It doesn't particularly concern me in that we are aware that with the VAT cut that was introduced back in 2011, when we last hit an economic crisis, we saw the impact of that and the very positive impact of that for tourism. It enabled tourism at that time to recover at a far greater pace, and it also enabled tourism to be one of the fastest growing job creators of any industry at that time in the country.
It was, as you say, at 9% for quite a few years, but frequently we heard during that time complaints from customers that they really weren't seeing the benefit of this.
Again, I would say that that is probably just a view of customers. We would say that reducing that is an opportunity to stimulate demand. Having worked in the industry for as long as I have, be it from every sector's point of view and through tour operators who trade internationally and bring tourists into the country, I can assure you that that rate was passed on to the customers. We made sure that it was, and indeed it did stimulate the demand that we required. It was appreciated by customers, and they would be able to see it on their bill. I mean, it is a value-added tax, so the reduction has to be passed on to the customer.
But there's nothing to stop somebody in a hotel or a restaurant or wherever jacking up the price in the meantime.
Yeah, but you know what? At the times that we're in right now, nobody is looking to jack up prices. We are talking about businesses that are distressed more than they have ever been before due to the terrible impact and crisis that COVID has brought to our doors. These are businesses that are opening now to do business, having been closed for almost 3.5 months. They absolutely need to trade and invite people in through their doors. They have taken huge precautions and invested hugely in their products to alter their businesses so that customers can come and enjoy their experiences safely with us. So really, it's in nobody's interest to do that. We know that that stimulates demand. We can see that it's going to make a big change to our colleagues across the border, across in the UK. And other European states have actually used this as a tool to actually stimulate demand as a result of COVID as well. Bear in mind, Ireland has, the Republic of Ireland has the highest VAT rate of over 30 European countries right now. So, you know, a reduction, as we have called for, is about stimulating demand. It's about aiding the recovery of the tourism sector, which isn't going to happen overnight. It is going to take time. But we are keen and anxious to make sure that we do all we can in the survival phase, particularly as we work towards recovery, to make sure that we help our customers come back to the best value we can offer.
Let's bring in John McGrillan, who's Chief Executive of Tourism Northern Ireland. Talk to us about the impact of COVID-19 on tourism in the north. What's the situation at the moment?
Well, I think the situation in Northern Ireland, as it is right across the globe, I mean, on the, I think it was probably about the 19th of March this year, the world's tourism industry essentially went into deep freeze. So in the same way, you know, we've seen no customers come into the Republic. That's been the same in Northern Ireland. And as a result of bars being closed, restaurants being closed, hotels being closed, the industry has been effectively without any source of income now for close on to 4 months. So the challenges that Ruth has just sort of set out for the industry in the Republic are mirrored north of the border.
Is it fair to say that you welcome what happened yesterday, this new rate, even though it's only going to last for 6 months?
Well, certainly the next 6 months is going to be absolutely critical for the industry. So anything that is going to help drive demand, and I would agree with Ruth, this isn't about, you know, increasing the profitability of the businesses. This is about giving an opportunity to drive people through the doors and bring more business to their door. So that is really important. I mean, the industry in the north and the industry in the south are almost totally dependent upon the domestic market for this particular season. So encouraging as many people to go out and spend over the next 6 months is going to be vital to saving those jobs that we all want to save, and make sure that we have an industry in place to respond when demand picks up again, hopefully in the spring of next year.
There's been a lot of debate over the past couple of weeks about where people should go on their holidays. How confident are you that people from the south will consider going north this summer?
Well, in any given year, we probably have about 600,000 people come and take short breaks in the north. So, I mean, our expectation is that we will continue to see those valued customers come north of the border. I don't see this really as a competition. We have people in the north who take breaks in the north and take breaks in the south, and that applies, you know, for people in the south taking breaks in the south and coming north. So we don't see ourselves in some sort of a pitched battle with Fáilte Ireland or with the industry in the south. It's, I think we have a collective role to play here in trying to get as many people to take, you know, those people who had been otherwise taking a break overseas, perhaps, you know, to spend that money and spend that money at home.
Ruth Andrews, to go back to you on this, looking at what you've been saying over the past few days, you also want to make it easier for some foreign tourists to holiday here. But when there's still so much concern over the virus, is that wise?
Well, certainly we would always say that the public health and safety is first and foremost in a priority. And we have done a terrific job here in Ireland in making sure that we have suppressed the virus, and we need to make sure that we continue to do so. That being said, there are other countries across Europe who've also done the same as ourselves, who are as anxious as we are to make sure that we get that containment held in place. But we are now at a stage where we do, as an island nation, and tourism is an international traded service, and there are huge amounts of businesses that depend on getting in and out of the country. So we do need to look at safe ways of reducing or relaxing the current quarantine measures. The government are looking at that. They will release a list on the 20th of July of green air bridge countries, and we will work with the government to ensure that we do all that we can to make sure that when those countries can return to us, when people can return to travelling between countries that have similar levels of containment, that we will play our part in that. But obviously, public health is first and foremost, and we are keenly aware of that. But the aviation industry is a huge part of business here in Ireland, and we have to make sure that we're doing all we can.
All right. Ruth Andrews and John McGrillan, thank you both for joining us this morning. It's 7:45.
A government housing scheme which promised to deliver over 20,000 houses by next year has resulted in just over 2,000 homes so far. The Local Infrastructure Housing Activation Fund, or LIHAF, was launched 4 years ago, a 200 million fund designed to enable developers to build homes on lands left unused because of a lack of necessary infrastructure. Sinn Féin want the scheme scrapped, but earlier this week, the new housing minister said the scheme would continue. We asked to speak to the Minister for Housing, Dara O'Brien, but he isn't available to us. We asked for a written response from the Department of Housing, but they haven't sent one. Owen O'Brien is Sinn Féin's spokesperson on housing. He's in our studio this morning. Owen O'Brien, why do you want the scheme scrapped?
Well, we're launching a detailed report this afternoon looking at the scheme. And I suppose there are two reasons we're calling for it to be scrapped. It was intended as a fund for developers who, because of a lack of their own funding, needed infrastructural cash. And in exchange for that infrastructural grant, it would deliver some level of affordability, 40%.
When you say infrastructure now, what do you mean?
You would be talking about roads, you'd be talking about bridges, or you'd be talking about some sewage infrastructure. So the idea was you would have had developers, with or without planning permission, who wanted to go on a development but were short of this crucial infrastructural cash. In exchange, according to the department, back in 2016, at least 40% of the properties would be sold at a discount rate. The difficulty is, if you look at many of the developers who have got this fund, they don't need it. They're some of the larger, more profitable developers, according to their balance sheets and their annual reports. Crucially, it hasn't delivered the 20,000 homes that were promised, nor has it delivered any affordability. In fact, in the three schemes where the discounted units have been delivered, you're looking at prices of between 290 and 450,000 euros. So people got it who didn't need it. It didn't deliver affordability. And there would have been better ways of using this 200 million euros to deliver affordable homes. And that's why we're saying, given not only our criticism, but the criticism of the now Housing Minister, Dara O'Brien, when he was in opposition, let's scrap the scheme and let's invest government funds in the direct delivery of affordable homes by local authorities.
In the Dáil on Tuesday, Dara O'Brien said that he will, quote, continue to encourage housing delivery supported by LEHAF, that construction of infrastructure and housing has started on many projects and over 2,000 homes were completed to the end of last year. About 40% of homes delivered under LEHAF will be sold at rates which provide a discount on market prices. Up to 3,000 will be social housing homes and the remainder will be sold at market rates.
So the difficulty is, if you look at a number of the recipients of the infrastructure fund, those houses would have been built anyway. Out of my own constituency in Adamstown, for example, there's a significant LEHAF fund there. But the developer in that instance didn't need the money, and you can see that from their annual reports. The crucial thing is this. 200 million euros is a lot of money. If that money had been given directly to local authorities back in 2016 as a rolling fund for the delivery of affordable homes for sale, you would have had over 3,000 affordable homes. And when I say affordable, I mean less than 250,000 euros to purchase. Instead, what we've got is a total of 2,000 homes, none of which are affordable. This is the wrong way to do things. And Fianna Fáil in opposition were very, very critical of Fine Gael's private sector-led, private developer-led approach to delivery of affordable homes for working people. And I think this is a litmus test. If Dara O'Brien isn't true to his early criticisms and continues this scheme, then what we're seeing is Fianna Fáil adopting Fine Gael housing policy. And that's not good news for working families desperate to buy homes at genuinely affordable prices.
Before I let you go, we were talking to Fionnán Sheehan of the Irish Independent earlier on. He was referring to their front page story on the Irish Independent this morning. Now, second TD admits ban for drink driving while a learner. This is Sinn Féin TD Pat Buckley. Should any TD with a drink driving offence now come forward to allow for full Dáil transparency, in your view?
Absolutely. And let me be very, very clear. Driving under the influence of alcohol is wrong, and particularly for public representatives who should be showing leadership, it's doubly wrong. Pat's case was widely reported at the time. He got a 3-year ban and, in fact, hasn't returned to driving, has never driven a car since. That doesn't make it any less of an offence. People lose their lives because of drunk drivers, and it is something we have to stamp out.
Eoin Brin, Sinn Féin's housing spokesperson, thank you for joining us. It's 10 to 8.
The Taoiseach said the government's July stimulus will be radical and far-reaching. It's due to be unveiled the week after next. Leo Varadkar was speaking as the UK Chancellor unveiled the British government's economic stimulus plan. Conal McCrillia, chief economist with Davy, is on the line. £30 billion is what Rishi Sunak believes the UK will need to spend. Conal, it's ambitious. Do we need to do something proportionate here? And what would we be looking at if so?
Well, it's around 1.4% of GDP in the UK, so I think that's seen as a significant stimulus. But the issue in the UK is that they're withdrawing their jobs furlough scheme. So you've got workers on their schemes in the UK. They're planning to withdraw those schemes from October. So if they move off those schemes and start to claim the level of universal benefit in the UK, that'd be a very big hit to their two incomes in the UK. So they have a slightly different issue to ourselves in that their rates of welfare benefit are considerably lower than our own. So effectively, Rishi Sunak is in a race against time where he hopes the economy recovers and jobs growth comes back in the UK before the end of that particular scheme. So we have many of the same issues here. We're seeing the fall off in unemployment claimants already. So some progress, but obviously a fear that the number of jobs that won't be replaced or come back, particularly in, say, tourism, it could still be very, very high. So I suppose there's a difficult issue around the labour market there, which we need to think about. So if you compare us to the UK, I think the UK has been much more aggressive in terms of the kind of business supports, the credit guarantee scheme they've implemented there. And I suppose when we see the scheme from the July stimulus from the government, we'll really be looking for the details around the credit guarantee scheme where the legislation will go through, and maybe some of the terms of the scheme may be amended to make it more likely banks have been lending money to small businesses who are facing very severe liquidity constraints at the moment.
And when it comes to that liquidity scheme, will it be necessary to triage businesses here? And would we have to be blunt in that exercise and say some are just not going to survive and maybe it's pointless pumping state money into them?
Well, it's a very difficult issue that has to be resolved. The Minister for Finance, I think, is on record as saying that Irish banks will still have to have some skin in the game. It's not going to be 100% guarantee as in the UK. So, there's very difficult judgments to be made. Does the state really have any role in supporting businesses which may not be viable going into 2021 when the economy has reopened? And does that make sense? So if it isn't going to be 100% guarantee, there's still a commercial decision to be made about whether it can be profitable.
Then
we may well see some companies not support.
Connell, sorry, your line seems to be dropping out there, but we might just leave it there. But thanks very much indeed for talking to us this morning. I'll have more business news at 8:30. Now it's back to Gavin.
It can't rain all the time, can it, Siobhan Ryan?
Hopefully not. Yeah, thanks, Gavin, and very good morning now from Met Erin. Well, today it's starting out quite cloudy with patchy mist, drizzle and low cloud for a time yet across the south and east. Now, whilst sunny spells will develop widely, a few heavy showers will occur today too. Only the east of Leinster will see most of these. Highest temperatures this afternoon of 14 to 19 degrees Celsius, coolest across the northwest, and that's in a light to moderate northerly breeze. Now, there'll be some further showers early tonight across the east and later across the northwest, but otherwise it will be mostly dry. Rather chilly tonight though, with lowest temperatures of 5 to 9 degrees and possibly dipping lower locally. Now, tomorrow Friday will bring a mix of sunny spells and scattered showers, some of those heavy across the northwest. Driest or even fully dry though across southern counties, but it will feel fresh tomorrow with moderate northwest breezes. Highest temperatures of 13 to 17 degrees. Now, for the weekend, lots of dry weather for most of us. Saturday, a largely dry day in over the country with a mix of cloud and sunny spells. Highest temperatures on Saturday will come in anywhere from 16 to 20 degrees Celsius with light westerly breezes and mildest conditions on Saturday across Leinster and the east of Munster. And Sunday at the moment, well, mainly dry and very pleasant over Munster and Leinster with sunny spells. Highest temperatures across the south and east ranging 17 to 21 degrees, but it is looking like it will fare cloudier in over the north and west with outbreaks of rain gradually moving in off the Atlantic and highest temperatures in these parts of 15 to 18. Southerly breezes then over the weekend on Sunday will be mostly moderate and fresh up along the Atlantic coast. Today then, in brief, when lingering mist, drizzle and fog across the south and east will clear, and while sunny spells will develop widely, a few heavy showers will develop too, with the east of Leinster seeing most of these. Highest temperatures today, a little bit milder than recent days, with afternoon highs of 15 to 19 degrees Celsius, and that's in light to moderate northerly breezes. That's it from me. A very good morning.
Good morning again. With the time coming up to 8 o'clock, you're listening to Morning Ireland with Gavin Jennings and Rachel English. We're live on RTE Radio 1 and RTE News Now. Here with the news is Karen Creed.
26 pubs may be prosecuted for breaches of the public health regulations and licensing laws following the easing of the COVID-19 restrictions last week and the reopening of pubs and restaurants. Most of the pubs were found not to be serving food along with alcohol. Our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds.
Gardaí carried out 6,830 checks on pubs and restaurants last weekend as part of Operation Navigation. 2,785 were found to be open all over the country, and the vast majority were in compliance. However, Gardaí say in some pubs they found customers drinking alcohol, but no evidence of food also being consumed, and no evidence of receipts to show that food had been sold. Under the health regulations, alcohol can only be sold to a person at the same time as they order a meal for at least €9. Gardaí also say they found pubs allowing large groups at the one table with little to no social distancing, no advisory signage and no COVID-19 contact tracing recorded. Some pubs complied with the regulations after being warned by the Gardaí, but 26 have now been identified for possible prosecution and files are being sent to the DPP.
The government will launch a public consultation process today on guidelines for remote working, which has increased significantly since the COVID-19 pandemic. The guidelines are intended to address issues arising from remote working, including health and safety, employment rights and data protection. Our industry and employment correspondent, Ingrid Miley.
Since the pandemic struck earlier this year, the world of work has changed dramatically, with thousands of workers now operating from home. But this raises huge issues, including health and safety, insurance, data protection, privacy, and the right to disconnect, not to mention higher utility bills for workers. Earlier this week, the Financial Services Union called for urgent government action to develop guidelines on remote working, and today the government will launch a public consultation process aimed at doing just that. Taoiseach and Minister for Enterprise, Trade and Employment Leo Varadkar described the pandemic as an accelerator of change that was coming. The deadline for submissions from employers and employees is the 7th of August.
The National Association for People with Intellectual Disabilities has expressed concern over a guidance document that has been issued by the Health Service Executive to reopen day services. Inclusion Ireland said day service capacity would be reduced and the guidance is non-committal regarding reopening timelines. Our social affairs correspondent, Alva Keneally.
Day services for people with disabilities have been closed for more than 3 months since COVID restrictions were introduced. Since then, families of people with intellectual disabilities who would normally attend day service facilities have been caring for their loved ones at home. When the latest COVID restrictions were lifted, there were numerous calls on the Health Service Executive to publish guidelines to enable day service providers to open. The HSE did that yesterday evening. Inclusion Ireland says the 72-page document is non-committal on reopening timelines, and it says there are indications that some day service staff which have been redeployed elsewhere will not return immediately. The organisation says that means that day services will reduce in capacity to pre-COVID times, which it says will put further pressure on those with intellectual disabilities and their families.
Eurozone finance ministers are to elect a new president of the Eurogroup later today, following the resignation of the incumbent Portugal's Mario Centeno. Ireland's minister Pascal Donoghue is one of three candidates nominated for the position. From Brussels, our Europe editor Tony Connolly.
Ireland's finance minister Pascal Donoghue is up against two candidates. Nadia Calviño, the Spanish finance minister, who is, on paper at least, the lead candidate. Pierre Gramegna, the Luxembourg finance minister, is making a second attempt. It's a straightforward majority vote. The first candidate to get the support of 10 finance ministers becomes president. If there's no clear winner in the first round, the candidate with the fewest votes bows out, and it's a straight runoff for the last two nominees. This is where Pascal Donoghue, who has lobbied hard as a consensus builder and a bridge between North and South, may have a chance. But the outgoing president was from the centre-left family, and they will want to hold on to the position, meaning the Spanish finance minister remains the favourite. The result should be known around 5 o'clock Irish time. Tony Connolly, RTE News, Brussels.
A rise in the number of people seeking treatment for crack cocaine use has been described as a worrying trend by the Health Research Board. According to the board's annual report, the number of people being treated for crack cocaine increased by 44% between 2018 and last year. Our Dublin correspondent, John Kilrain.
The Health Research Board report found that the recent increase in treatment for crack cocaine comes against a backdrop of cocaine cases overall trebling since 2013. Dr. Anne-Marie Carew, research officer with the board, said in general, those seeking treatment for cocaine are male, 30 years of age, in paid employment, and most likely to use alcohol as an additional drug. However, she said there is a rise in the numbers of chronic drug users mixing crack cocaine and heroin, who tend to be unemployed and homeless. Abuse of opioids, which is mainly heroin, is still the biggest reason for drug treatment, but it is decreasing. Meanwhile, cocaine has overtaken cannabis as the second most common problem drug.
The time now is 5 minutes past eight.
RTE Radio 1 weather, sponsored by SuperValue. Our online shopping delivers value straight to your front door. It's got to be SuperValue.
Mostly cloudy at first this morning with patchy mist, drizzle and low cloud across parts of the south and east. Sunny spells will develop, but there will also be a few heavy showers, with the east of Leinster seeing most of these later on. Highest temperatures of 14 to 19 degrees.
Porrick Lodge is here with what it says in the papers.
Taoiseach's office apology over North visit cock-up is the headline on the front of the Irish Examiner. Political correspondent Aoife Moore reports that the Taoiseach's office has been forced to apologise to Northern Ireland's First Minister after a government source overzealously briefed a media outlet that the first meeting between the new Taoiseach and the North's First and Deputy First Ministers was to take place today, despite no meeting being organised. A government spokesperson said a scheduling difficulty was the reason the visit wasn't going ahead and the problem wasn't in Dublin. But a senior source in the Northern Ireland executive told the paper that they knew nothing about any planned meeting until contacted by journalists, and the Taoiseach's office had since apologised for an administrative cock-up. Details of what we can expect in the July job stimulus plan are carried in the Irish Times. Youth unemployment has been highlighted as a key focus. Measures under consideration include a significant investment in apprenticeships as well as back to education allowances. But the report from Jennifer Bray and Jack Horgan-Jones says some government sources express doubt about the possibility of a reduction in VAT for the hospitality sector. The Irish Independent reports that Sinn Féin TD Pat Buckley has revealed he was driving on a learner's licence when he was caught drink driving in 2013. The Cork East TD said the incident that led to a three-year driving ban was still a great source of shame and a massive mistake. We're also told that Fianna Fáil TDs were yesterday still seeking to identify the source of similar revelations about the newly appointed Agriculture Minister Barry Cowan. A report from Ken Foy says specialist detectives are actively investigating reports that under pressure crime boss Daniel Kinahan has left Dubai and is travelling from country to country in the Middle East. If the information given to officers by high-level informants is correct, it shows that pressure on Kinahan from Gardaí and other police forces is having an effect. The Irish Daily Mail gives front page coverage to comments from the Taoiseach to Leo Varadkar that working from home will become the new normal. He described COVID-19 as an accelerator of change that was coming. According to the Irish Daily Star, Gardaí could lose 2 weeks' pay if they travel abroad during the pandemic. In a circular issued yesterday, Gardaí and Garda staff were advised against travelling overseas and were warned that the two-week period of self-isolation after returning to Ireland may be treated as special leave without pay. The Irish News highlights a warning from Northern Ireland's chief medical officer that travellers from Britain present the greatest risk of bringing coronavirus into the north, while the Belfast Telegraph covers a claim from the UUP that a predicted £32 million overspend on the new Casement Park would fund five new primary schools. A call from the Irish Co-op organisation for the 2 metre social distancing rule to be reviewed in March is covered in the Irish Farmers Journal. A spokesperson highlighted an unsustainable situation where you can sit at a 1 metre distance in Mart canteens, which are operated by independent contractors, but then have to sit 2 metres apart at ringside. David Quinn, manager of Car New Mart in Wicklow, said you'd nearly need a good stick with you to keep the 2 metre rule in place. The ongoing closure of all but two gates in the Phoenix Park is causing major traffic headaches for local businesses and residents. That's covered in the Herald. The Irish Sun reports that RTE is to show highlights from recent Late Late toy shows. And finally, the Irish Daily Mirror tells us that The Simpsons have been voted as viewers' favourite television family. The Trotters from Only Fools and Horses took second place, with a tie for third between the Royal Family, the Addams Family and the Flintstones.
Well, as we've been hearing, 26 pubs may be prosecuted for failing to comply with coronavirus restrictions. Files on the 26 are being sent to the Director of Public Prosecutions. Gardaí say they carried out almost 7,000 checks on almost 3,000 licensed premises last weekend, and the vast majority were complying with the regulations. Our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds has the story. Paul, tell us about Operation Navigation.
Yeah, well, Rachel, when the pubs were initially shut under the public health guidelines, the Gardaí checked thousands of them to ensure that they remained closed, which they say the vast majority did. And when they reopened last Monday week, they continued those checks. Now, they found very early on that some pubs were ignoring the public health guidelines that were brought in to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. So not just the Gardaí were concerned, but it was also industry representatives and members of the public had made some complaints. So last Friday, they set up Operation Navigation. navigation. Now, the Deputy Garda Commissioner at the time gave an operational order to local managers all over the country, assistant commissioners, chief superintendents and superintendents. They were directed to organise thousands of spot checks on pubs in their areas over last weekend. The operation began at 7 p.m. last Friday night and ended on midnight on Sunday.
What did they find?
Well, they say they carried out 6,830 checks on pubs and pub restaurants mainly. I don't think they went into any hotels and they didn't go to any off-licences. And these checks, they say, were carried out to ensure that the pubs and restaurants were complying with the public health regulations to stop the spread of the virus. Now, the Gardaí say that during these visits, they continued what is their policing policy of a graduated response. They initially engage, then they explain, and they encourage people to comply before, as they say, as a last resort, moving to enforce the law. So they say they give people who they suspect of breaching the guidelines plenty of chances to come in line. Now, 2,785 of the pubs that they checked were found to be open all over the country. The vast majority of the Gardaí say were in compliance. However, they say in some pubs they found customers were drinking, but there was no evidence that they had consumed any food, which is a requirement, and no evidence of any receipts to show that food had been sold. And when they asked for receipts, these weren't produced. Now, under the health regulations, alcohol can only be sold to a person at the same time as they order a meal for at least €9. The penalty for a breach of that regulation can be a fine of up to 2,500 or up to 6 months in prison. The Gardaí also say they found pubs allowing large groups of people congregate at the one table, evidence of little or no social distancing between individual people. They say there was in some pubs there was no advisory signage and there was no COVID-19 contact tracing recorded. There was nobody at the door with a notebook. Customers' details weren't being recorded. They say they went back to check some of the pubs twice and three times, and that some did comply with the regulations after they were warned that they were breaching both the regulations and the guidelines. However, 26 pubs were identified as the Gardaí field breaching the regulations. They have now been identified for possible prosecution. Files are being sent to the DPP because it's the DPP who will make the decisions, a decision whether or not the licence holders are to be charged.
Are the Gardaí likely to be out again in the coming days, do we know?
Well, operation navigation is continuing. I mean, the Gardaí have no power, however, to enforce social distancing guidelines, signage, numbers at tables, because these are all simply guidelines. They have powers of enforcement in cases of breaches of the regulations. So there is a difference between the guidelines and the regulations. And the regulation is very clear in relation to publicans and pubs must serve a substantial meal. And the test for that is a meal that will cost €9 with alcohol. And if they don't, they can be prosecuted. But the Gardaí also have powers under the licensing laws. A pub, a restaurant or a hotel requires a declaration of suitability from a Garda in order for its alcohol license to be renewed. And the Deputy Commissioner of Policing and Security, John Toomey, said in a statement this morning that obviously the large level of compliance is very welcome, but he said the Gardaí remain concerned that a minority are potentially putting the health of their customer staff and everyone that they come into contact with at risk of getting COVID-19. So that's largely why these prosecutions are being sought. He also says the Gardaí want to send a clear message to publicans that they will be opposing the liquor licences of those who they believe are not complying with the guidelines and regulations when renewal applications come up in September, unless they come into compliance.
Separately, Paul, there have been developments in the case of a couple who went missing from County Meath 5 years ago. What can you tell us?
Yeah, Willie Maughan and Anna Varslavan went missing in April of 2015. And now, when the Gardaí began the investigation, it began as a missing persons, but they now believe they have been murdered and their bodies disposed of. The investigation has been continuing for 5 years. We've had appeals from the family. The Gardaí believe that they were attacked at a compound in County Meath, possibly because the people who attacked them are involved in serious criminality, and one of the main suspects is a major player in the ongoing feud between the criminal gangs in Drogheda. Now, the Gardaí suspect that the couple were attacked because they may have seen something, or those people who attacked them suspect that they may have been prepared to give information to the Gardaí in relation to criminality. Now, yesterday was quite an intensive day. There was four people arrested yesterday, a man in his 20s. There was also three other people, two of them in their 50s. They're all being questioned this morning at Ashbourne Garda Station in County Meath. There were also searches carried out at the compound where the Gardaí believed the couple were last seen alive, and at the surrounding lands. And members of the Defence Forces were brought in to help with that search. Now, we understand that the people in custody, they're being detained under Section 30 of the Offences Against the State Act, which means there's a suspicion that they may have information or have had access to firearms, and that allows the Gardaí to question them for up to 72 hours. But the Gardaí don't believe that they were centrally involved in the murders, but they do suspect that these people have information and may have been on that compound on the day the couple disappeared.
Paul, many thanks for that.
As the easing of lockdown restrictions cautiously continues around the country, residents of the Aran Islands are in disagreement about reopening for tourism. Business people say they have been decimated by the COVID pandemic and welcome the return of visitors this week. Other islanders, including a local GP, feel the lifting of restrictions is moving too quickly. Our regional reporter, Theresa Mannion, took the ferry to Inishmore to meet locals and tourists.
The Rossaville ferry to Kilronan Pier on Inishmore would normally be packed in July, but there were less than 100 passengers on this sailing. They all wore masks. Most were Irish people taking mini staycations, and there were some day trippers.
Well, I'm from Sligo, he's from Louth, and we just had the week off, so we said we'd come out here for the day. So it's literally just day trip, like.
When the weather's so good.
You're all sisters.
We are. Yes, yes, we are. Yes,
you're on a staycation.
Yes, we are. Yeah. Well, we usually go to Portugal every year, so this year we're just going to stay local and stay in Ireland.
The kids were happier coming out here than I've ever seen them. They'd rather be coming down here than the Canary Islands now at the moment, because they were just delighted to get out.
Well, Inishmore is not the Canary Islands today.
Not today. All right, limo.
Inishmore is the biggest of the three Aran Islands, with a population of around 800 people. To date, there has been just one confirmed case of COVID-19. The GP here says she wants to keep it that way. Dr. Marion Broderick is opposed to the early reopening of the island.
My own opinion is that nationwide this is happening too quickly, and certainly from the island's point of view, considering that our patients have to travel in public transport on the boat with all of these visitors, unlike mainlanders who can get in their car and go for their appointments without meeting anybody, I think we should be going slower. People are worried because the numbers are we've only been open a week and large numbers are here already.
Around 250 islanders took part in a vote recently, and the majority were opposed to reopening so soon. But many more say they are dependent on the summer season for their very livelihoods. PJ O'Flaherty and his wife Grace run T. Joe Watty's pub and restaurant.
We're nervous as well, because we are complying with all the necessary conditions to keep the island safe. We don't want to see anyone get sick on the island. But we also, if we don't make some money, we'll be sick ourselves as well. Do you know what I mean? There'll be a lot of people under pressure if they don't make some money for the summer, because there's something else to look forward to until next year.
It's deadly. It's out there. We can't underestimate it. But it hasn't been here, and we hope it won't be here. And I am adamant that you can't get infected on my watch.
Vincent McCarran is in his 70s and has lived on Inishmore for 47 years. He is nervous about the island reopening.
We have a lot of old people here who have a lot of health issues. And there are people here who have not left this island since January. Now, that's hard to believe, but that's quite a fact. Now, I left 2 weeks ago today to go to hospital because I had to, but I wouldn't have left had I not have to go to hospital. I'd be still on the island, and I have a great fear because I have health problems as well, and if it comes in here it could do an awful lot of damage to this island.
Clodagh Gill runs a B&B on Inishmore. She says she can't afford not to open her door to visitors.
Financially, it has destroyed us completely. Like, do you know, I've three children dependent, two going to university. I have a mortgage, and we just have to, everybody in the country has to be responsible for themselves. It's okay if you can afford to stay wrapped up in cotton wool, that's fine, but I can't.
I can understand that business people are feeling the pinch, as they are nationally, but however, you have to come to a point where you decide whether you're going to protect public health and safety or the economy.
The summer season has ramped up on Inishmore. Aaron glamping and camping saw all of their pods booked out in 3 days. Here's Frankie Moran.
It's unbelievable. We really, really thought that we weren't going to be open. I thought I was going to be out of a job. It was really stressful, scary time. And just the fact that the government decided to reopen the island, it just gave us all such new life and we were just ready to go. And I mean, the Aran Islands is almost like the Canary Islands, like this year in Ireland, you know, it's such an adventure. So people are kind of like dying to get out of their house to go on holidays. They want to get the kids. They want to come here to Inishmore. And it's just fantastic. We're so happy to see people again.
We couldn't book in till 2, so we went down and hired bikes. And then we went to the shop and got ice creams. The beach is right beside where I'm staying. I think it's absolutely good. And I think I'm having a great time.
I think you are too.
Sean Tansey from Kildare ending that report from Theresa Mannion on Inishmore.
Scientists at Trinity College in Dublin have been given almost €5 million in funding from Science Foundation Ireland and AIB to set up a centre of excellence in the immunology of COVID-19. The research will try to answer key questions about why some people are more susceptible to disease than others. It will also focus on the design of effective vaccines and novel treatment approaches for the virus. Our science correspondent George Lee has been finding out more. George, there's obviously huge interest in the search for a vaccine. Talk to us, if you would, about what's happening at TCD.
Well, it's a very interesting place to be, actually. I went down there to find out exactly what they are doing, or to just get an idea. And, well, there's a lot of people working in the Trinity Biomedical Science Institute, and particularly in the area of immunology and vaccines at the moment. And they're very excited to get the money that they got, because they have 11 specialty labs down there working on various aspects of science and biomedical stuff. And certainly they're very focused in relation to the work which has been done to try and make a breakthrough in relation to COVID-19. They're working on all aspects of it. They're working on therapies, they're working on vaccines and so on. In those labs, with the money that they've got, they're hoping to hire about 22 new posts. International collaboration is really key. A lot of those new people will come from abroad and elsewhere, so they're going to search the world for people who can help them to help get the answers even better. So that's very interesting. So I spoke to Kingston Mills, who's one of the professors down there, and he's looking at the whole area of vaccines. And what I was interested in, because we know that there's 150 to 170 kind of vaccine efforts going on at the moment in the world, so what exactly were they doing in Trinity College? And what he said is that one of the things they work on is trying to boost the immune system's response, the memory, because when people become or even they may well get antibodies, or they may get a vaccine in relation to COVID-19, will their system remember it? Will their immune system remember it so that the immunity would last? And he said what they're working on is a thing which called adjuvants, basically was the term he used, which boosts the memory of the immune system, which means that if somebody does get a vaccine, that that will help it to last for longer. And they work internationally. So I asked them exactly what they do, and this is how he said it.
We're sort of informing them in terms of the way they can do it better. So what's happening right now is it's a very, very quick rush to get a vaccine. And they're using existing technology that they have applied to other infections. And what we're doing is finding ways of refining that, adding to the vaccine to make it more potent, adding these molecules called the adjuvants, which are better than the existing adjuvants, which will make it more potent in terms of the memory response. In other words, that the response would persist for longer and people would be protected for years rather than just months after vaccination.
Kingston Mills talking there about one aspect of their research at Trinity College. What else are they doing, George?
Yes, so Luke O'Neill is working on the area of therapy, Professor Luke O'Neill on therapy. So Kingston is working particularly looking for a vaccine, but that can take time. And in the meantime, what do you do to help people? And one of the things which in Luke's lab they've been doing for quite a while is they've been working on an anti-inflammatory molecule called itaconate, I think is how he pronounced it. And he's very, very excited about this because they discovered it about 2 years ago. It's a very, very potent anti-inflammatory molecule, and it's produced by your own immune system. And what they are looking at is that when people who get very sick in relation to COVID-19, one of the big problems is that their immune system is getting inflamed, is getting irritated, it's making them very sick, it's building up fluids on the lung, and they get particularly sick. If you can block that, you can give people a hugely improved chance of getting through the disease. So he's very, very excited about the prospect of what that itaconate molecule can do. So he says the whole world is watching at the moment everywhere, that in all of his time, in his 35 years in science, has never been quite like this. The amount of international collaboration is enormous. It's a really exciting thing to do. They're working with collaborators in Harvard and MIT in Massachusetts, collaborators in Holland and in Belgium. And he says, science really at times is about trying, trial and error. A lot of it is failure, but they're very excited. So this is how he explained, if not a vaccine, then we've got to go for a therapy.
It's a stepwise thing. Prevention is always better than cure. That's the famous truism. Vaccines prevent, okay? If we can't get a vaccine, it might take time. The worry of side effects is in the back of our minds all the time. Remember, plan B is a therapy for people in hospital who've got the disease. And that could be an antiviral to kill the virus on contact. We never got a vaccine for AIDS. The antivirals work in AIDS. They're tremendous. They kill the virus, you see, and that's another option. And then thirdly, anti-inflammatories. Once the lungs begin to get problematic and the patient can't breathe, give them an anti-inflammatory and save the lungs, and then the patient doesn't die. And dexamethasone did that. 30% effect in that trial, fantastic. So we'll see more and more of this. And the good news is, George, there's so many shots on goal. The analogy I give is like a football match. There's 100 players on the field and they're trying to score a goal. You know, one of them will get the goal in. And can you imagine in September, if a potent anti-inflammatory is discovered, the fear begins to go away. You don't see the scenes we saw in that primetime documentary of people dying in front of the doctor's eyes and they're desperate to save the patient. So an anti-inflammatory will have a role to play in this. And again, we'll take the fear slightly away from this.
George, so much has happened so quickly over the past few months, but obviously there's still an awful lot that scientists don't know about this disease. What's the level of optimism like in Trinity?
I think it's quite high. Now, what Professor Luke O'Neill explained was that he is an optimist, and he's counteracted by his colleague Kingston Mills, who's more of not a pessimist, but I suppose he takes a different approach. So they really balance each other out, and they both seem very happy with the way that works. So the whole issue is they've got to move very fast, and whether or not that whole issue of getting it into patients, how quickly could they get these anti-inflammatory results into patients? They're talking about they're already in animal trials, and with the drug they're getting very good results, and it could move very quickly into humans and go hell for leather as such. But in terms of optimism, it really bounces off particularly Luke O'Neill. This is how he explained the optimism issue.
Just from my honest to God sort of analytical look at this, we have to be optimistic, George. You've never seen so many vaccines being tested ever, okay? We know a huge amount about how vaccines work. Three of them are in phase three, one's in humans already. There's 170 in total. One of those has to work. If it doesn't, by God, we're unlucky. Let's put it that way. Secondly, the amount of knowledge we have about, in my area, inflammation, the past 30 years, massive knowledge of inflammation. We know all the component parts. We know what might go wrong. We know the cell types. And again, we've drugs to fire at that. So you have to put money on it, let's face it. Because without all that knowledge, what's the use of it in a sense, you see? So you have to be optimistic. And I know the other sign, George, is the drug companies, remember, they're the big boat fighting the shark here, by the way. They've got deep pockets. They're fully on board. They're all collaborating with each other. The vaccine, four drug companies are now collaborating on a single vaccine. Never before in history have four big competitors. It's like Coke and Pepsi joining to make a new product kind of thing, you know? Never have ever seen this. So for heaven's sake, you know. I mean, people ask me, am I being overly optimistic? All I can say is this, I can't think of anything else we should be doing, you know? Everything's been thrown at this, and with a bit of luck, now we still need a bit of luck, we'll get there.
Professor Luke O'Neill, Chair of Biochemistry at the School of Biochemistry and Immunology in Trinity College Dublin. Our thanks to him, also our thanks to Kingston Mills and to George Lee, our science correspondent. It's 8:32.
Let's get the latest business news now with Brian Finn.
Thanks, Gavin. About 2,200 businesses availed of the suspension of gas network charges during the pandemic lockdown, according to figures from Gas Networks Ireland. The semi-state company said it would forgo charges for 3 months for businesses not consuming gas as a result of COVID-19. Overall gas demand fell by over 8% in the second 3 months of the year as the pandemic restrictions came into force. Hoteliers here are reporting occupancy rates of between 23 and 26% for the summer months, according to the Irish Hotels Federation. This is based on confirmed bookings, and it compares to an average 90% occupancy rate over the summer months last year. The Housing Minister is to seek clarity on whether the public health situation merits a further extension of the moratorium on evictions and rent increases. The moratorium is currently due to expire on July 20th. The Minister was responding to calls from the Labour Party, which said renters had been disproportionately affected by job losses as a result of COVID-19. On the currency markets, the euro is trading at $1.13.5 and 89.8 pence sterling.
It's 24 minutes to nine, and Darren Vrehel joins us again. Morning to you, Darren.
And good morning to you as well, Rachel. Well, Major League Soccer returned in America last night, and a very moving moment of silence. Almost 200 players took to the field before the restart, and they had an 8 minute, 46 second moment of silence. The 8 minutes, 46 seconds, of course, the length of time George Floyd was pinned to the ground before he passed away. Players also wore black t-shirts, black gloves and black face masks. Now, over the years, we've all seen so many of these moments, but I think last night that was among the most powerful. The MLS teams are gathered in Florida. They're kind of having a playoff of their season in a World Cup style format. But what a moment that was. I've just put some video up on Twitter at Darren Frehel if you want to check it out. In the Premier League last night, and happier news, John Egan is at it again. He scored another goal. Two now in a week. Incredible stuff from him. Sheffield United 1-0 winners against Wolves. Egan on the mark with the only goal of the game. 93rd minute as well. Pretty dramatic. The win sees them go seventh. They're a point behind Wolves, and they're in pole position for a place in Europe next season. In fact, they're almost within touching distance of a top five, which could get them a Champions League spot yet. Let's hear from the man of the match and his second goal in as many games.
Well, John, what was it, 72 games with a goal, like the buses?
Mad, London buses. yeah, you wait so long for a goal and then I suppose you get a little bit of a bug. Yeah, 2-2, prolific now, so I think the gaffer has been asking for 10, so I've only got 8 more to go in the next 4 games.
Do you think there's something in that? The fact you scored at Burnley maybe made you attack that one in the last minute there, just a little bit more?
Yeah, I think it always gives you a bit more belief when you score. Haven't scored for a long time. It's been kind of playing on my mind a bit. You know, the gaffer's been hammering me. But look, I got one the other day. I got one again today. Today was obviously vital, the winner, which is the main thing. So, yeah, hopefully I can keep adding that to my game now and get a few more.
Yeah, he's certainly enjoying himself at the minute. A header last night, back to a more traditional centre-half goal. Might be pushing it to get 10 of the season, but he's doing brilliant, isn't he? Mo Salah scored twice as champions. Liverpool beat Brighton 3-1. Should have scored a couple of more too. Missed a couple of chances. Jordan Henderson went off injured in that game. Looked very serious. Looked like a knee injury. And his manager, Jurgen Klopp, sounded pretty concerned after the game.
It doesn't look too good, if I'm honest, but we have to wait. We have to wait until we get more information.
Manchester City beat Newcastle 5-0. Burnley had a 1-0 win at West Ham. West Brom are top of the Championship after a 2-0 win against Derby County. Leeds are back in action tonight. If they're to win, they'll go back on top. The former Irish international John Sheridan has been confirmed as the new manager of Waterford FC. Now, the big golf news yesterday was the Ryder Cup. The 2020 staging of the event postponed for a year because of the COVID-19 pandemic. European Ryder Cup captain Padraig Harrington has welcomed the decision, and he confirmed that there will be a change in qualifying for Team Europe, so the point standing will be frozen until the new year. The postponement also means that Adair Manor will host this event in 2027, and that'll be the centenary of the competition. Greg Allen has been speaking to Padraig Harrington.
That's great news for Ireland. And it is probably appropriate that we're back in the uneven years for the Ryder Cup, considering it is the 100-year centenary. Huge complications behind the scenes, but I definitely think, you know, considering the situation, it is a bit of a bonus for Hedaire in 2027 that there will be the centenary of the Ryder Cup.
You were named Ryder Cup captain in January of 2019, and you're going to be going all the way to September of 2021, hopefully. Nearly 3 years of your life devoted to being Ryder Cup captain. How is it for you?
Well, I hope I've done most of the work. You know, we were just, when this all started off in March, we were just getting into the nitty-gritty of what form are the players in. Previously, for the previous year, it was all administration stuff, but January 1st, you know, we'd be back to looking at the form of the players, who matches up with who's a likely partnership, and who's going to play with who in the months leading up to, who am I trying to get to build a relationship with a rookie. That sort of stuff is going to happen, which I was missing out this year. Like, there's players in that team that wouldn't necessarily know each other that well, and that's not great for a Ryder Cup. You want to build those bonds, and you know, I wanted to build that bond, and I was relying on this 6 months coming into the Ryder Cup to just give a little bit more of myself, which wouldn't be something I would normally do. I'm quite a competitive individual at golf events, and I was, you know, committed to spending a little bit more time with the rookies and getting to know the rookies and building that relationship. And that all fell by the wayside. Like, we had dinners planned, we had events planned through the last 6 months. So hopefully next year I'll have a good run at 9 months where I can, you know, build those relationships with my team. And we know it's very important for us in Europe that we go in there with a very strong bond in our team. And, you know, given a better run into it, I think that's possible.
You know what? I was editing that piece this morning, and as I was editing it, I was listening to Morning Ireland, and I was hearing about the 60,000 new COVID-19 cases in America in the last 24 hours. I know it's a long way off yet, but will it be possible to have fans at that match in 2021? I know it's a long way off and it'll become a big talking point in the months ahead, but you would worry about it. Finally, there's racing this afternoon at Navan, and the action gets underway at 1:05.
Day services for people with disabilities have been closed for more than 3 months since COVID restrictions were introduced. Now the HSE has put forward guidelines to enable day service providers to reopen. But an association who represent people with disabilities say that services will be much reduced, putting further pressure on people and their families. We'll talk to Inclusion Ireland shortly, but first let's hear from the Campion family in Navan in County Meath. They started an online petition calling for the reopening of services for people with intellectual disabilities. Their 28-year-old daughter Deirdre has Down syndrome. Pre-COVID, she attended Prosper in Navan, but with lockdown restrictions in place, she has now been at home for 17 weeks. Her family say she has become withdrawn and quieter since the service was closed. They talked with our social affairs and religion correspondent, Ava Keneally.
When's your birthday?
In November.
November.
November, mine too!
Oh.
Yeah, what date?
The 15th.
Deirdre Campion will be 29 years of age this November. She has Down syndrome, and it's been 17 weeks since the day service that she attended in Navan closed when COVID restrictions began. She misses her friends, the library, the restaurant, and all the activities she did there. The thing she misses the most?
It is in this.
Fitness and Prosper.
Deirdre's fitness classes were incorporated into her 30-hour-a-week care. That has been reduced to 1 hour a week, as her sister Laura explains.
At the moment, she's receiving 1 hour from her key worker, and during that time, they go for a walk. And then also, she has one Zoom call per week. It's impacting on Deirdre's mental health and well-being. And for people with intellectual disabilities, they really need the interaction, the social, the face-to-face interaction that a day service would provide, and their friendships, and to see her peers and the other staff members.
Without those supports, Deirdre has become withdrawn and less excited by each new day. Before the COVID restrictions were introduced, she got up every morning and marked the day off her own calendar, which hangs in the kitchen of the Campion home. Those ticks stop on the 29th of April, and she hasn't turned a page on the calendar since.
Every day really is like Groundhog Day for Dee. She hasn't really been anywhere, because these services are really what are offering her that lifeline with her friends and her peers. and that she doesn't have that right now.
Just regarding your parents, how difficult has it been for them?
It's been tough for them to watch Deirdre become more withdrawn. She's quieter. She lies on her bed all day. And to know that you feel that there's no voice there for Deirdre and our family, and we feel very much left out of this phase three and the reopening of the country.
Such was the extent of Laura's frustration that she set up a petition online for other families in the same situation.
We've almost 6,000 signatures now, and people from all over the country have been in touch with me, siblings, parents as well, of other adults with intellectual disabilities. And what we really need here now, Alva, is we need clear timelines, a plan of action, and we need answers as to when our loved ones can access these services again. There needs to be choice available to service users. We're not mitigating the risk here. We know that there is a risk involved, but these are a lifeline. And Deirdre, really, her world has become so small. And with phase three, I really felt it was so disheartening to know that she still has no access to her day service.
That's Laura and Deirdre Campion speaking to our correspondent, Alva Keneally. Enda Egan is CEO of Inclusion Ireland. Enda Egan, good morning.
Good morning, Gavin.
You've read the HSE guidelines. What's your understanding of how it will be decided who returns to daycare and when?
I think, Gavin, firstly, it's quite important just to look at daycare and its primary function. And the primary function of daycare is to provide meaningful activities for people with the intellectual disability. However, the secondary function is that it provides a break for the family. And right now, families are telling us that they are at the end of their, you know, their mental, emotional and physical capacity. They're at burnout level. And it is crucially important that they service levels get up and running, number one, very quickly, and number two, back up to full capacity. It would be our understanding from reading the document that there's a very clear message coming from this document, and it states quite clearly in the very first pages that, you know, the levels of service across the COVID-19 emergency period will not be at the same level as they were pre-COVID. That's a huge concern for our members. In terms of how that decision, I suppose, is going to be made, there is prioritisation criteria set out quite clearly in the document for service providers. And I think the HSE have done quite a good job in terms of putting this document together, and it is quite clear in its function. However, what is clear from this is that there is not going to be the same levels of services available. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that the capacity, when you introduce social distancing in today's services, the capacity is not going to be there to have the same amount of people present in the building as it was pre-COVID. The government are not putting a capital fund in place to allow service providers to go out and to either, you know, rent new premises, bigger premises, or to make modifications to their current premises to allow more people to come to day of service. And we must remember that schools and some older person services already have that capital grant available to them.
Okay.
That's not happening. The other thing here as well is that the redeployment of staff that were working in day services, some of them have been moved to residential services. There's no timeline as to when those staff are going to come back. It does look like that many of them are going to remain in residential services, providing day services to the service users in residential settings.
Okay.
Correct.
The Minister responsible, Anne Rabbitt, has said in a statement that she's delighted that service users and their families will now have certainty that day services will gradually resume during the month of August. The guidance issues provide a strong framework for service providers, as well as the reassurance that they will be guided by public health advice. What happens to those who won't be able to get into daycare now?
That's the question that really is unanswered. What's going to happen here is that that responsibility is going to, you know, push back on the family. The state has a reputation, unfortunately, in this country of pushing the care provision back onto the family wherever the opportunity presents. And that's something that we cannot allow to happen. It is worth stating here, Gavin, that we now have four ministers with a brief extending right across the disability issue. And we would appeal to them as a collective to sit down with the three leaders of the political parties. And we need to remember here that a programme for government has been put together, you know, based on implementing the societal changes that the nation voted for in the last election. And I believe that, you know, there is a very good real opportunity here for the government to, you know, realign their expenditure in line with the social issues that people want dealt with. So it should begin by the HSE, you know, it should begin by the government providing a fund to the HSE to deliver pre-COVID levels of day services. I would also add that within the programme for government here, the government have stated that they are going to work towards increasing day services, and we're only 2 weeks into this current government, and it now looks like they're actually going to decrease day services, and that cannot be allowed to happen.
And Egan, CEO of Inclusion Ireland, thank you for speaking to us. 8:52.
A pandemic of missing and stolen dogs. That's what animal groups are calling a spate of disappearances and suspected dog thefts all over the country. Cian McCormack has the story. What's been happening, Cian?
Well, Rachel, dogs are going missing all over the country. You just have to look online. There are social media pages dedicated to missing and stolen dogs. One such page is called Missing Dogs Ireland. It's on Facebook. It has over 15,000 members. And its administrator, Lynn Cullen, says there has been a sharp rise in dog disappearances.
Well, I am doing this about 10 years now. The last few weeks, it has just got out of hand. It's actually like a pandemic of missing and stolen dogs. Every single hour of the day, somebody's dog is gone. Missing, stolen, never to be seen again.
You helped reunite a dog with its owner in Limerick. What happened?
I helped reunite a dog that had been missing for 2 weeks, and 3 weeks later, the dog was stolen again.
Cian, what's driving this theft? Why now?
Well, the market appears to be driving it. And why now? There's just a bigger demand now. Charities like the DSPCA say more people decided to get dogs during the pandemic because they're at home more. And this means prices have shot up. Pete Roach has watched this closely in Galway.
We have five little miniature Jack Russells that we're very proud of. There's quite a phenomenal demand for such. I know that before the lockdown, the value of a miniature Jack Russell would be somewhere in the region of 100 to 150, maybe 200 max. Right now, on any of those sites, they are asking in the region of anywhere between 600 and 1,000 euro for 6 and 7 week old pups. They are being stolen left, right and centre to satisfy a gluttony that's out there by some who are willing to steal and sell them on at prices like I just quoted. Very fortunately, a very good an associate of ours gave me the tip off that our little breeding pair, our breeding trio, were going to be lifted. Now, I can tell you, Cian, that we had a miniature stolen on us before. It broke the hearts of a lot of people in our house. We don't want a repeat of it. And to be honest, microchipping or not, they'll still steal them. So it's a word of caution to people. Mind what you have. Don't leave them unattended.
Don't leave your dogs unattended. Pete Roach is also a Fine Gael councillor in Galway, and he plans to raise this issue at Galway's County's Joint Policing Committee. And meanwhile, the dog charity there, which is called Modra, is deeply concerned. Here's its co-founder, Marina Fiddler.
Unfortunately, there has always been dogs going missing, alleged stolen. But it does seem to have ramped up a lot at the moment now. But I know that from some of the dogs that have been stopped at the port, that some of these are adult dogs that have been taken from somewhere. We're very concerned about the fact that the price of dogs is rising and that they're seen as so lucrative now, because obviously it will encourage people to steal or to take dogs that they find and not give them back. It will also encourage unscrupulous people who think that they can make easy money by breeding a dog. And so, yes, we're very concerned about it.
Marina Fiddler there of Modra. Cian, obviously this isn't just a Galway problem, it's nationwide. You've been talking to the DSPCA in Dublin.
Yeah, that's right. It's concerned. It says there's been an increase in the number of animals going missing, but it hasn't been inundated with reports of stolen dogs. Here is the DSPCA's Gillian Bird.
We're always concerned when animals go missing because it's tragic for the family when an animal goes missing. Absolutely. And if there is now a trend in people stealing animals, we have to be very concerned as to sort of say, well, why are they stealing them? Are they stealing puppies? Are they stealing adults? Are they specifically stealing animals? Have they scouted them out to see Is it a breeding female? Has she not been neutered? Can she produce puppies so they can breed them for the you know, very hungry audience out there of people who are desperate to get puppies and are paying huge amount of money? So it is definitely a concern of ours.
You've been talking to one family, Cian, whose dog went missing.
Yeah, I have. And it really is devastating for families when their dogs go missing. The Davitt family in Dublin is heartbroken after their 11-year-old Jack Russell, Jack, went missing. Here's Lisa Davitt.
My dog Jack has gone missing. He went missing between 12:20 and 1:10 on Monday, the 22nd of June. He just disappeared. So we don't know. We feel maybe he was taken. He's my mom's baby. She always referred to him as my baby. She's distraught without him, as we all are. We're not eating, we're not sleeping. He's a very valued member of the family.
What are your concerns?
You know, just petrified that he's fretting and he's upset and he doesn't understand why he's not with us anymore and getting cuddles and, yeah, not the horrible things that you fear that he's going through right now.
Can you elaborate on that for me?
Yeah, just from what you hear, the stories of potentially dog fighting rings or being bred on, say, like puppy farms. So I'm just praying that that's not happening to him. We're heartbroken. We're truly devastated and worried. We're crushed. But absolutely crushed.
Is there any small thing that's now gone from your life?
His little face. Just missing him, looking in your eyes and giving you like a lick or a cuddle or a wiggle, like just his company. Honestly, I can't imagine never seeing him again. It's the not knowing and the lack of closure. Do you know, if he passed away, he passed away. You'd grieve him and you'd know. It's just, the torture of wondering what he's going through. And yeah, it's I miss him. I need my Jack back.
Lisa Davitt there. Well, more details on Jack are on the Facebook page Get Jack Home Safe. And finally, Gardaí are aware of dog thefts. Its crime prevention unit has guidelines and warns people to watch their dogs. If a dog is stolen, it should be reported immediately to Gardaí. Rachel.